Well, it's the book that fans have been waiting 100 years to read. Mark Twain is finally publishing.
Some old fans there.
Well,
Mark Twain has some pretty old fans.
Sometimes you pass down the anticipation of a book.
Holding on to read the book.
You're trying to say that some of our centenarians haven't been waiting for this book?
That's true.
It is Mark Twain's secret autobiography, and he decreed that it shouldn't be published until 100 years after his death, and we're going to get a look at it now. First of all, we have Patrick Henry Bass with us, our friend, senior editor at Essence Magazine. And first of all, let's talk about Mark Twain. Is this all about control? Is this about him getting the last word?
One of the greatest creations of Samuel Clemens was the character Mark Twain. So, you know, and the marketing ploy here, I mean, Steve Jobs and the people at Apple, you know, they wished that they could come up with this type of marketing strategy. He was brilliant. I mean, in many ways, the centenarian mark for him, it really had nothing to do with anything. He just sort of picked that date, you know, like 100 years after my death. It was more about his daughter, Clara, and his editor at the time. A lot of the material in this book had already been released. I mean, Mark Twain, 74, the average life expectancy for men at that time was 47.
Right.
He had written 50,000 letters in his lifetime. Many of the letters that he had written, you know, people sort of released. So, you know,
And he wrote travel journals.
We know that he hated Jane Austen. We know that he had his issues with Edgar Allan Poe. We know that the villain in this book is his landlady. He really hated her. You know, who doesn't hate their landlord or landlady, right? You get the sense of a deeper personal Twain. He's heartbroken about the death of his son Langdon. He never really talked about that. He only talked to his sister about it. And Langdon died from diphtheria, and he felt that he caused that death. They were in a carriage together, and he felt that his son was exposed to the cold because he had gotten lost in thought. So that's a heartbreaking revelation. And also, his wife Olivia, the love of his life, he felt that he kept her away from her family because he was quite a megalomaniac, quite narcissistic. Yeah. And I can't wait to read your book 100 years from now, John Ockenberry.
Oh, well, no, I forgive him, but, you know, he was a very interesting literary celebrity of this period of America, and he cultivated it very well, and this is part of all of that.
Right, and also just in terms of just a literary technique, with Huckleberry Finn, he reinvented the novel.
Right.
And what you see here with this memoir is he really reinvented the way that one would tell one's life story.
Oh, interesting.
Because he did it through dictaphone. So his style is very stream of consciousness.
Yeah,
the editors here, who worked on it for 6 years, they have not interrupted his narrative flow at all. So you see what was to come.
But here's the thing.
I mean, probably, I obviously have not read this yet, but I would imagine that reading it 100 years after his death changes the way I see and absorb the material. And that's true anytime you publish a book after somebody has passed on, wouldn't you say?
That's correct. Now, there are two more volumes to come. I think that his daughter, Clara, was real obsessed about his views on Christianity. In fact, they didn't want the views on Christianity published until 500 years after his death.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so we're going to wait around for that, right, John?
That's it's where he says Jesus was a robot.
I mean, he really became disillusioned not only with Christianity, but also with American international politics. He's sort of like Nostradamus. I mean, he could see everything coming except for Facebook.
All right, but let's talk about other books. I mean, autobiographies that are posthumous are relatively rare. But we do get books, both fact and fiction, that are published after an author has passed away.
Exactly. Some things you want to keep to yourself, like Andy Warhol. I'm afraid to say the word Bianca Jagger because we may be taken to court. You know, she was highly upset after the Andy Warhol diaries came out. He would go to all of these parties, and then the next morning he would take notes. He would have sort of like Mark Twain. It was sort of like a dictaphone situation.
And those diaries were published by the Warhol estate or by someone
they were published by a publisher, you know, and but he trashed everyone. I mean, even body odor of some of the celebrities, you know.
What about the unfinished work of authors that ends up being published because they're so famous?
Well, like Answered Prayers by Truman Capote, you know, did he really finish, you know, that, you know, what he thought was going to be his masterpiece, what he thought was going to be his Proust-like novel? We don't know. We know that, you know, that Lecoq Basque, the short story that emerged in Esquire, ended his relationship with socialites like Babe Paley and Slim Keith, and it sent him, you know, further into a downward spiral in terms of his alcoholism.
It didn't redeem him being published.
Not at all. Now, there's Tony K. Bambara's Those Bones Are Not My Child, which was edited by Toni Morrison after her death. And this was Toni K. Bambara's masterpiece about the Atlanta child murder. She had worked on it, you know, for the rest of her life. And it's a brilliant, brilliant book. And, of course, there's Confederacy of Dunces.
Which is an amazing Lazarus story.
Yes,
really.
Correct. Which the author committed suicide.
Right, and his mother brought it to...
And it took a long time for the book to come out. I mean, the book was published by a Louisiana University Press.
Won the Pulitzer.
Went on to win the Pulitzer, but, you know, it only sold like maybe 2,000 copies.
When it was first published.
But it took a long time for that book
You could argue that the death of the author... that a posthumous book could possibly have a more sympathetic read. I mean, I'm thinking of, say, the Stieg Larsson books, which people have benefited.
Yeah. Exactly. Or if you have a celebrity, like there was the Katharine Hepburn. Now, remember, a lot of authors and well-known people who release when the works are released posthumously, it wasn't as if they kept their opinions to themselves when they were alive.
Right.
You know, so Andy Warhol, you know, he said very little. That's what made his book. I think people would see him say things like gee or hey, or, you know, he was not loquacious. That's what made him so fascinating. But Katharine Hepburn and Mark Twain, they never kept their opinions.
Stieg Larsson is an interesting case. You also got Bolaño, the Chilean writer.
Yeah, correct, yes.
Who died. And those books, I think, really benefited in a weird way from the death of the author.
And there's also David Foster Wallace. You know, the publishers are now releasing some of his posthumous works. Now, these were also perfectionists with words. When you're thinking of O'Toole,
John Kennedy Toole.
Right. The Neon Bible never should have been released. There was the second book, Confederacy of Dunces. He didn't have enough time to work on that book. And so now people people are comparing Confederacy of Dunces, the Neon Bible, to Confederacy.
And just like a painting becomes more valuable after the author passes away, or would anybody care about the Mystery of Edwin Drood if Charles Dickens had finished it?
Exactly. And with Mark Twain, because it was done through dictaphone, it wasn't as if he didn't have time to line edit the book. So it really is rambling, but it's Mark Twain rambling. So it's not like your granddad rambling. I mean, this is really artful rambling.
It's a piece of Twainness. But
it's
maybe
history
not
and biography. Yeah, absolutely.
Patrick Henry Bass, senior editor for Essence Magazine. You have a book in the closet waiting?
I have plenty of books in the closet. It's all about the takeaway.
Don't kill yourself over it. Don't kill yourself over it.
Thanks so much.
So just in time for the holidays, we're launching a series of what home means to you. Could be a subject for a book. And it's our latest iPhone app assignment. Snap a photo or record audio or video of the things that make home for you, that say home for you. Make your way over to the iTunes store of our website to download the iPhone app. And if you don't have an iPhone, you can still take part. Go to our website and tell us what means home to you by calling 877-8-MY-TAKE, 877-869-8253. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.